You're now going to be addressed by Megan Fitzgerald. Megan was admitted to practice on the 15th of April 2008 and signed the bar roll on the 19th of May this year. So she's relatively new at the bar, but she has a wide range of practice areas apart from areas that we're interested in this morning. And they include alternative dispute resolution mediation, commercial, criminal and family law, disciplinary tribunals, professional negligence to mention but some. Megan was at Landers and Rogers prior to coming to the bar, and those of you who are familiar with Landers and Rogers practice will understand that that involves acting at least in part for the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee. And Megan, while she was at Landers and Rogers, certainly carried out a lot of work on behalf of the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee. And as a result of that, she has a lot of knowledge of how, why, when and where the complaints can come so far as a practitioner is concerned. She's appeared in all jurisdictions in Victoria, and I understand she's going to draw on her practical experience to identify potential pitfalls. Please welcome Megan. Thanks, Megan.
Now that Theo's gone through all of the case law from this year, I don't propose to actually talk about any cases. I'm simply going to talk from experience working for the LPLC and also more recently for the Legal Services Commissioner. It really isn't hard for things to go wrong, and it can happen to the best of us, although hopefully it's more than the grace of God keeping us from going where Isaac Brott has gone. If you adopt good risk management practices at the beginning, it's easier to deal with problems when they arise. And essentially, the message from today is that prevention is better than the cure. A good defence is a defence, but it doesn't start fighting until the disease has set in. It's not going to stop you from incurring cost, inconvenience, and also a lot of stress. Practitioners, when they get sued or have complaints made against them, even if those complaints or cases are dismissed or shut down from the early stages, go through a lot of stress. If files are conducted well and kept in good order, problems are less likely to arise. And if they do arise, it'll be easier to nip them in the bud in the way that Theo described with the complaint that was made against him. It's really not uncommon for the Legal Services Commissioner to either dismiss things quite quickly or at least before they get to the tribunal stage if you can produce good file notes, things that show that you did the right thing and give them grounds to essentially make that call that the VCAT would not find against you. The same thing goes for a civil suit. If you've got a clear defence and that can be produced to the other side or referred to in the early stages, it's far more likely for a claim to be dropped on advice. So the first thing that any practitioner should think about at the outset is, who is my client? We heard about the unfortunate case of Mr. McNamara in relation to the wills, and that these sorts of things do happen more often than you realise, and it can happen with very experienced practitioners often because they become more relaxed about who they're dealing with and taking and not taking these initial steps and thinking about who it is they act for. Conflicts then arise. It can happen often in the insurance context where a lawyer is acting for both the insured and insurer, but there's a conflict potentially between the two of them. Or it can happen in situations. A common one is family law proceedings where parties should be given independent advice, for example, with the binding financial agreements, but the breakup's amicable and they say, no, we're fine, we don't want to pay for two lawyers. So it's just always very important to think from the outset, who is my client? Is there any reason why I shouldn't act for this person? And if in doubt, exercise caution, because conflicts aren't about reality, they're about perceived conflicts. The next thing that should be done at the outset to avoid problems down the line is talk about money. This is obviously a requirement under the Legal Profession Act, but it's also a really good way of managing expectations. Be upfront about how fees are going to be charged, what the basis for incurring them will be, when they'll be charged and paid, and make that really clear and put it in language that the client can understand. Problems can sometimes arise down the track, especially in no-win, no-fee type situations where a client gets slugged with a massive bill at the end of their hearing and finds that their compensation is drastically reduced by the amount of fees they have to pay to their solicitor, and that's when often upset occurs. Which leads quite conveniently to my next topic, which is that hell hath no fury like a client scorned. A happy client, a client who feels like they've been involved in their case, like they've been kept in the loop, like you've really done your best to fight for them, is much more likely to feel conflicted in making a complaint about you or bringing a claim about you. A client who feels like they've been treated like crap, on the other hand, isn't going to have those qualms. And so if there's any skerrick of a possibility that they can make a complaint or bring a claim, they're far more likely to do it. So always be as clear as you possibly can in your communication. Try to avoid confounding clients with legalese or making them feel put down by the way you speak to them. And as Theo so aptly demonstrated, the really difficult clients, the ones that demand too much of you, who expect all sorts of things and show a clear desire for litigation, are the ones that should be treated with the most caution and given as much respect as you possibly can. It can be really frustrating, and but it's always a warning sign that if this client is being difficult, demanding, complaining, that those are the clients where you need to tread carefully. It's best to try and involve them in decision-making, try and give them some purchase in a decision that's made. And a good example of this would be a case I was involved in that ran for a long time. We were acting for the barristers that had been involved in settling family law proceedings. Now, the barristers had a really strong defence. They had an advocate's immunity defence. And in normal circumstances, the claim would probably have only been brought against the solicitors. It certainly was much stronger against the solicitors, although arguably not strong against them either. But one of the barristers we acted for was a Silk. He was of a more senior age. He had been around a long time, and given that he, in the course of a two-year proceeding, didn't ever learn my name until shortly before the trial, I was known as Dear. And then when I said my name was Megan, he said, "Oh, isn't there a secretary at your office called Megan?" I said, no, I've spoken to her on the phone." And I said, "Yep, that was me. And you know, when I was giving you advice, that's because I'm a lawyer." You can see how this particular man had managed to raise the fury of his client. And there were huge amounts of documents in this particular case that involved your typical family law situation where a husband who had been involved in a family business had attempted to fritter away all of the family business funds in a range of trusts and other sort of arrangements to avoid having them go to his wife in the divorce, and then later wanted to blame his solicitors and barristers when a lot of it did go to his wife in the divorce. And it's my strong view that had this particular Silk treated him with a little bit more respect, even though he possibly didn't deserve it and he probably didn't particularly bring about a friendly situation, that the claim probably would have been dropped against the barristers. The next major point for things that should be thought about as early as possible is that a problem shared is a problem halved. If a client's claim is hopeless, do your best to tell them clearly and kindly as early as you can. And you might laugh, but I did once have an inquiry from a potential client who wanted to sue her hairdresser for a negligent haircut. Needless to say, that unrealistic expectation had to be dealt with quickly. If clients' unrealistic expectations are not appropriately modified, they'll be more likely to be upset at the end of things, especially if they end up with a bad outcome. In turn, they'll be more likely to sue their lawyer. The common example of this sort of thing happening is plaintiffs in personal injury proceedings who have perhaps been to a few different firms and perhaps not necessarily been given positive advice by the first couple, and then they've arrived at a firm that has said, we can make a claim for you. And certainly they can make a claim, but it's a statutory benefits claim, and the no one has taken the step, or at least haven't documented taking the step to advise them about the issue of negligence in common law claims. And when they finally do break it to them that they're not going to be able to prove a damages claim because there's no clear negligence, the client is very upset. The client then makes a complaint to the Legal Services Commissioner or to solicitors and seeks to bring a claim. And by that time, of course, the limitations period is over, and if they can put together some sort of claim, then you could be in trouble. The next topic I thought it worth addressing is sign-up notes. Now, these are commonly used often in the family law context where people come to trial and then don't want to run the trial, even though their lawyers are advising that they might get a better outcome at trial. And so if they're essentially acting against advice, the lawyers will then have them sign a note saying that they understand that the advice that's been given to them and they're going to choose to act against it. It's a bit of a safety blanket, and that's great, but it's really important if you're going to use a sign-up note to understand that they're not always a strong defence. You need to make sure that the client clearly understood it, that they understood what the purpose of a sign-up note is, and that is to use as a defence if they later turn around and complain about you or sue you. Because it's really common for clients to then get to a stage where they are unhappy with the outcome and say, well, yeah, I signed that, but I didn't read it, I didn't understand it, I didn't know what the point of it was. So if a client is going to act against your advice and you're going to have them sign a sign-up note, just make sure that they've read it, that you've taken the time to sit there and in a relaxed way go through it with them and check that they understand it. This one's an obvious one and probably doesn't need to be said to anyone in this room, but it does happen. People give advice and don't read documents, don't necessarily understand them, and certainly don't keep a record of them. So when it comes to a point of that advice becoming relevant, they have no way of proving what advice was given or on what basis. So it's just always important to keep copies of everything. And that becomes particularly relevant with solicitors' certificates of independent advice. We heard from Theo about the case with a solicitor's certificate. These cases come up all the time, and they're essentially the evil love child of Amadio and Garcia. In those cases, the banks weren't able to enforce guarantees against family members who had provided guarantees to their undeserving son or husband. And when the banks realised their problem, they decided that they would shift liability onto lawyers by having lawyers sign certificates saying that they had given independent legal advice to a guarantor without an interest in the loan. And what often happens nowadays is that people drop in off the streets into suburban law practices, or they go into a solicitor who's been doing other work for them, and they say, I've just got this document that needs to be witnessed. And without thinking too much into it, the lawyer does what they think is essentially witnessing a document, and ultimately they are certifying that they gave detailed advice about a matter that can result in a very hefty claim. The other option is that solicitors just don't worry too much about these, and in my view they should, and they do give the advice. They advise of what can happen if your son defaults on his loan and how you can lose your property, but they don't take a copy of the documents, they don't take a file note, and by the time it gets to a point where the guarantee is being enforced and the guarantor says, oh, but I never understood all of this and I was never advised, and the solicitor has no way of protecting themselves because they didn't keep a file note and they don't have a copy of the documents. In some cases, we've had solicitors who didn't open a file. And this, of course, leads to file notes. Memories don't remain with people, especially not if they are just doing what they do every day. Now, it's really, really important to keep file notes. I know this gets said a million times over, but file notes should be detailed, they should be legible, they should be written in language that other people can understand, so the odd little scribble of some sort of code is not helpful if a complaint ever is made. If you make a file note that's not contemporaneous, then you should make a note in there about why it wasn't made contemporaneously and why, when you did make it, you had recall of the events. And as a cautionary tale against ever making notes after the event without a note about why it was made after the event, I'll tell you about a matter I worked on where a client alleged, as a plaintiff, that they had been given advice in relation to purchasing a property, and they said that they'd been given the advice over the phone. They'd called up on a particular date and were told, yep, that all sounds fine, sign the documents, you'll be right. The solicitor says that the advice wasn't given that day, and they have a file note to show that all they said was, send in the documents, we'll have a look at them and then we'll give you the advice. Now, there was a written file note that indicated that that was the advice or the conversation that took place, but it was written in handwriting on the bottom of an email, which was dated from the day that the conversation allegedly took place. And it was only when you looked at the very bottom of that printout that you realised that there was an automatic date that had been printed when the email had been printed that was about 2 months after the date that the conversation allegedly took place. And this was the only document that could prove or disprove the case. When that was brought to the attention of the solicitor, they said that they'd had an accident with a cup of tea, spilt it on their file, and they'd had to replace the file note, so what they'd done is they'd reprinted that email and then rewritten the note in handwriting exactly as they had written on the original note, but without some sort of note to say, I rewrote this on this date because of this issue, that one's going to be a big credibility problem. So it's always important that if something is unusual in any way, just make a note of it. An obvious one, but a bit of a killer, put dates in your diary. A claim can be quite average against one tortfeasor, but as soon as a lawyer who is held to very high expectations misses a time limitation, it becomes a very strong claim against that lawyer by magic. It'll also take years off your life being sued, so it's just never worth taking the risk. And my final common area of problems is organisation. Cleanliness is next to godliness. Don't let this be your work situation. And I've left this one to last because it's probably my favourite story about acting for a solicitor. I was sent by the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee out to the offices of a solicitor we were acting for because a claim had been made against him, and the file relating to the claim, which he said could prove his defence, was missing. And the LPLC wasn't confident that he would be able to locate his file, and so they said they were happy to pay for me to go out there and search his closed files. So I went out to his office, which really did look like this from the point when you walked in, that his poor receptionist was sitting behind a desk that was piled above her head with loose papers. And I was shown to a room that contained his closed but not yet archived files, and they were piled in boxes that were all splitting at the seams. And I had to go through all of these boxes. There were files everywhere. They were dusty. Nothing was spiked in chronological order. Loose documents had moved from one file to another, and there was probably another 10 claims in there. I went through there, those files, and needless to say, I didn't find the file we needed. And I went back to the office, and after speaking to my boss, I was told that I would be expected to also go through the documents that he said he had in archives. We had a bit of a joke in the office about how this time around I should probably go prepared. I should take some gloves and a dust mask. But I thought, it's a bit rude. I probably shouldn't, because he's going to be taking me out to where he stores his files. I got a taxi out, and I thought it was a bit odd that the address was somewhere out in the suburbs, but who knows where archives are kept. And I arrived at a nice suburban house and was met at the door by a nice old Greek lady and a few little kids. She seemed to know who I was and invited me into the house, and I sort of looked around, and then I saw the practitioner, and he showed me down to the crawl space beneath his mother's house. And then he pulled on a pair of overalls. So I went in there and we had to search through even more dusty, even more broken boxes that contained files that were in even less order. And it's quite possible that that file that would have proved his defence was in amongst those boxes, but we were never going to find it. And he was never going to have a defence. So a fairly extreme story to demonstrate the principle, but organisation, keeping your files in order and spiking documents so that they don't get muddled or lost is really important if you're ever going to have to come to defending a claim. And the last thing that should be said is that if things do go wrong, it's tempting to have a nervous breakdown and just ignore that file, put it in the black file box. But problems happen, and they happen to the best of practitioners, and they can almost always be nipped in the bud, dealt with quickly, and dealt with minimal stress if you take steps as quickly as you can. The best thing you can do is talk to someone about it. Ideally, talk to an experienced colleague or a friend who actually practices in the law, ideally. And if there's not someone that you think you can speak to in your firm, then there are also alternatives of the LIV Ethics Advice Line and the Bar Ethics Committee, who can give you anonymous advice. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Anybody got any questions for either of our wonderful speakers? Okay, well, if not, thank you very much.
Can I just briefly say two things? There's been a bit of discussion about conflicts this morning. It's a real problem. It's one of the issues that gets practitioners into trouble time and time again. And may I give you a very simple example that many practitioners do not seem to ever think about? Often you will have a conflict between acting for a company and a director of that company, although you need to know whether the director's coming to see you in his role representing the company or in his role representing himself as a director. It's a real problem that people just forget. The other is a very, very simple rule of thumb, if I may put it that way. I was reminded of it when Megan was telling you about the family law silk who thought that she was nothing other than a secretary at the firm. But it really is very important. To the client, every client believes their case is the most important case there is. You mightn't think it's that important, but the client does, and you must always approach the client's view of the case on that basis. Thank you very much for attending, and if you'd join with me in thanking our two guests for their wonderful addresses.